dying from it. Might even wish I was. I never would. I was going to have to walk around with a hole in my heart forever. I was going to hurt for my sister until the day I died. If you don't know what I mean, or you think I'm being melodramatic, then you've never really loved anyone.
You don't mean that.
Like I said, you don't know me. He laughed.
Look at your hands.
I looked. They were both wrapped around his forearm. Beautifully manicured pink nails with frosted tips were curled like talons into his suit, trying to loosen his grip. I hadn't even realized I had lifted them.
I know people, Miss Lane. They think they want to die. Sometimes even say they want to die. But they never mean it. At the last minute, they squeal like pigs and fight like hell.
He sounded bitter, as if he knew from personal experience. I was suddenly no longer quite so sure Jericho Barons wasn't a murderer. He thrust me against the wall and held me there, a hand at my throat, his dark gaze moving restlessly over my face, my neck, the rise and fall of my breasts beneath my lace camisole, moving majorly over my breasts. I might have snorted if oxygen had been in plentiful supply. There was no way Jericho Barons thought I was a hottie. We couldn't have been less each other's type. If he was Antarctica, I was the Sahara. What was his deal? Was this some new tactic he was going to threaten me with? Rape instead of murder? Or was he upping the ante to both?
I am going to ask you one more time, Miss Lane, and I suggest you not trifle with me. My patience is exceedingly thin this evening. I've matters far more pressing than you to attend. What did you see out there?
I closed my eyes and considered my options. I have a pride problem. Mom says it's my special little challenge. Since I'd initially taken such a strong, defiant stance, any cooperation now would be caving. I opened my eyes. Nothing.
What a shame,
he said.
If you saw nothing, I have no use for you. If you saw something, I do. If you saw nothing, your life means nothing. If you saw something, your life...
I get the point. I gritted. You're being redundant.
So, what did you see?
Let go of my throat. I needed to win something. He released me and I staggered. I hadn't realized he was holding me on my tiptoes by my neck until my heels weren't touching the floor and suddenly needed to be. I rubbed my throat and said irritably, "Shadows, Barons, that's all I saw."
"Describe those shadows for me."
I did, and he listened intently until I'd finished, his dark gaze boring into my face.
"Have you seen anything like this before?"
he demanded. "No."
"Never."
I shrugged. "Not really." I paused, then added, "I did have a kind of weird moment in a pub the other night."
"Tell me,"
he commanded. I was still standing between him and the wall, and I needed more space. Physical proximity to Barons was disturbing, like standing next to a highly charged magnetic field. I slipped past him, taking great pains not to touch him, a fact that seemed to amuse him greatly, and moved toward the sofa. I began recounting the strange dual vision I had had, the hostile old woman, what she had said. He asked me many questions, pressing for minute details. I wasn't nearly as observant as Barons, and I couldn't answer half of what he asked. He made no attempt to hide his disgust with my failure to be more investigative with either the odd vision or the old woman. When at last he finished his interrogation, he gave a sharp laugh of disbelief.
"I never thought there might be one like you out there. Unaware, untrained, unbelievable. You have no idea what you are, do you?"
"Crazy?" I tried to make a joke of it. He shook his head and began walking toward me. When I instinctively backed up, he stopped, a faint smile playing at his lips.
"Do I frighten you, Miss Lane?"
"Hardly. I just don't like being bruised."
"Bruises heal. There are worse things in the night than I."
I opened my mouth to make a smart-aleck comment, but he silenced me with a wave of his hand.
"Spare me your bluster, Miss Lane. I see through it. No, you're not crazy. You are, however, a walking impossibility. I have no notion how you survived. I suspect you must have lived in a borough so provincial and uninteresting that you never encountered one of them, a cloistered town so utterly lacking distinction that it was never visited and never will be."
I had no idea who his them were that had or hadn't visited, but I couldn't argue with the rest of it. I was pretty sure Ashford was registered with the state of Georgia under P for provincial, and I seriously doubted our annual fried chicken cook-off or Christmas walk, featuring the same half-dozen stately antebellums each year, distinguished my town from any other scattered throughout the Deep South. "Yeah, well," I said defensively, "I loved my hometown. Point?"
"You, Miss Lane, are a she-seer."
"Huh?"
"A she-seer. You see the fae."
I burst out laughing.
"This is no laughing matter,"
he said roughly.
"This is about life and death, you imbecile."
I laughed harder. "What, some pesky little fairy's going to get me?" His eyes narrowed.
"Just what do you think those shadows were, Miss Lane?"
"Shadows," I retorted, my amusement fading. I was getting angry myself. I would not be made a fool of. There was no way those dark shapes had been anything more substantive. Fairies didn't exist, people didn't see them, and there were no books about magic that had been written a million years ago.
"The shades would have sucked you dry and left a husk of skin scuttling down the sidewalk on the night breeze,"
he said coldly.
"No body for your parents to claim. They would never know what happened to you. One more tourist gone missing abroad."
"Yeah, right," I snapped. "And how many other lines of bull are you going to try to feed me? That the Shisadu really is a book of dark magic? That it really was written a million years ago by some dark king? How stupid do you think I am? I just wanted to know what the word meant so I could maybe help the police find who killed my sister."
"How did she die, Miss Lane?"
Barron's asked the question soft as silk, but it slammed into me like a sledgehammer. I clenched my jaw and turned away. After a moment, I said, "I don't want to talk about it. It's none of your business."
"Was it abnormal? Horrific, Miss Lane. Tell me, did her body look as if animals had gone at her? Hard?"
I whirled back around. "Shut up, I hate you," I hissed. Impatience blazed in his eyes.
"Do you want to die like that, too?"
I glared at him. I would not cry in front of him. I would not think about what I'd seen the day I had had to identify Alina's body. Not in my worst nightmares did I want to die like that. He peeled my answer from my face, and half his mouth drew back in a smirk.
"I didn't think so, Miss Lane. Listen to me and learn, and I will help you."
"Why would you do that?" I scoffed. "You're hardly the Good Samaritan type. In fact, I think the word mercenary has a little picture of you beside it in the dictionary. I don't have any money." Both sides of his mouth drew back this time in a snarl, before he quickly recomposed his face into a mask of smooth European urbanity. Wow, I'd sure struck a nerve. Something I'd said had pierced his thick hide, and it seemed to have been the word mercenary.
"I can hardly leave you to die. It wouldn't sit well with my conscience."
"You don't have a conscience, Barons."
"You know nothing about me, Miss Lane."
"And I'm not going to. I'm going to talk to the police, and they're going to reopen my sister's case. I'm not going to see you again, or any stupid shadows. I'm not even going to ask you what the Shisadu really is, because you are beyond delusional. Stay away from me, or I'll tell the police all about you and your crazy ideas and threats." I snatched up my purse and drugstore bag and walked to the door.
"You're making a huge mistake, Miss Lane."
I yanked it open. "The only mistake I made was yesterday, believing anything you said. It's a mistake I won't repeat."
"Don't cross that threshold. If you walk out that door, you'll die. I give you 3-day odds at best.
I didn't dignify it with a response. I let the slam of the door behind me do that. I think he might have yelled something through the door, something weird like, "Stay to the lights," but I wasn't sure, and I didn't care. Jericho Behrens and I were done with each other. Or so I thought. It would turn out to be just one more of those things I was wrong about. Soon we would be living inside each other's hip pockets, whether we liked it or not. And believe you me, we didn't. 7. Later, I would look back on the next few days as the last normal ones in my life, though at the time they seemed anything but. Normal was peach pie and green beans, bartending and coaxing my car to the garage for the latest $250 Band-Aid, not investigating my sister's murder in Dublin. I spent all day Wednesday on campus at Trinity College. I spoke with the last professor on my list, but she had nothing new to add. I talked with dozens of Alina's classmates when their sessions let out. The story they told was so identical from one to the next that they were all either part of a vast X-Files conspiracy. I always hated that show. It was too vague and open-ended, and I like my tidy denouements. Oh, this was really who my sister had been while she was here. They said for the first 2 or 3 months she was friendly, outgoing, smart, someone others wanted to hang out with. That was the Alina I knew. Then suddenly she changed. She began missing classes. When she did show up, if someone asked her where she'd been, she behaved strangely, secretively. She seemed excited and deeply preoccupied, as if she'd discovered something far more interesting to immerse herself in than her studies. Then, during her last months there, she lost weight and looked exhausted all the time, like she was going out drinking and partying all night every night, and it was taking its toll. Edgy and nervous were two words I'd never associated with my sister, but her classmates used them liberally in describing her. "Did she have a boyfriend?" I asked. Two of the people I spoke with said yes, two girls who seemed to have known Alina better than the others. She definitely had a boyfriend, they said. They thought he was older, rich, sophisticated, and handsome, but no, they'd never seen him. No one had. She never brought him around. Toward the end, on those rare days she showed up for class at all, it seemed she was making a last-ditch effort to try to get her life back, but she looked weary and defeated, as if she knew it was a battle she'd already lost. Later that night I stopped in an internet cafe and downloaded new tunes for my iPod. iTunes loves my Visa. I should be more frugal, but my weaknesses are books and music, and I figure there are worse ones to have. I'd been hankering for the Green Day Greatest Hit CD, the song that goes, "Sometimes I give myself the creeps, sometimes my mind plays tricks on me," had been majorly on my mind lately. And I got it for the bargain price of $9.99, which was less than I would have paid in the store. Now you know how I justify my addictions. If I can pay less for it than I would at Walmart, I get to have it. I sent a long, determinedly upbeat email to my folks, and a few shorter ones to several of my friends back home. Georgia had never seemed so far away. It was dark by the time I headed back to the inn. I didn't like to spend much time in my room. There was nothing comfortable or homey about it, so I tried to keep myself busy until I was ready to sleep. Twice, while walking home, I got the weirdest feeling I was being followed.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please continue listening on disc number 3. This is disc number 3.
It was dark by the time I headed back to the inn. I didn't like to spend much time in my room. There was nothing comfortable or homey about it, so I tried to keep myself busy until I was ready to sleep. Twice while walking home, I got the weirdest feeling I was being followed, But both times I turned around, the scene behind me was a perfectly normal Dublin evening in the Temple Bar district. Brilliantly lit, warm and inviting, thick with throngs of pub-goers and tourists. Not a thing back there that should have sent a chill of foreboding up my spine. Around 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up strangely on edge. I pulled the drape aside and looked out. Jericho Behrens was on the sidewalk in front of the Clarin House, leaning back against a lamppost, his arms folded over his chest, staring up at the inn. He wore a long, dark coat that went nearly to his ankles, a shirt of shimmering blood red, and dark pants. He dripped casual European elegance and arrogance. His hair fell forward to just below his jaw. I hadn't realized it was so long because he usually wore it slicked back from his face. He had the kind of face you could do that with, chiseled, symmetrical bone structure. In the morning, I decided I'd dreamt it. Thursday I met with Inspector O'Duffy, who was overweight, balding, and red-faced, with pants belted low beneath a stomach that strained his shirt buttons. He was British, not Irish, for which I was grateful because it meant I didn't have to struggle with his accent. Unfortunately, the interview turned out to be more depressing than quizzing Alina's classmates had been. At first, things seemed to go well. Though he told me personal notes on the case were not a matter of public record, he made me yet another copy of the official report and patiently recounted everything he'd told my father. Yes, they'd interviewed her professors and classmates. No, no one had any idea what had happened to her. Yes, a few had mentioned a boyfriend, but they'd never been able to find out anything about him. Rich, older, sophisticated, not Irish, was all they'd been able to find out. I played him her frantic phone message. He listened to it twice, then sat back and knitted his fingers together beneath his chin. "Had your sister been using drugs long, Miss Lane?" I blinked. "Drugs? No, sir, Alina didn't use drugs." He gave me that look adults get when they think they're telling you something for your own good and trying to be gentle about it. That look pisses me off to no end when the adult is so obviously wrong. But you can't tell grown-ups a thing when they've got their mind made up. The decline her classmates described follows the classic downward spiral of drug use. He picked up his file and read from it. Subject became increasingly agitated, edgy, nervous, almost paranoid. Subject lost weight, looked exhausted all the time. He gave me that irritating, brow-raised, expectant, can't-you-see-what's-right-in-front-of-you look some people use, like they think they can cue the right response from you with it. I stared at him stonily, resenting the word subject clear to my toes. That doesn't mean she was doing drugs. That means she was in danger.
And yet she never told you or your parents a thing about this danger. For months. You said yourself what a close family you have. Wouldn't your sister have told you if her life was in jeopardy? I'm sorry, Miss Lane, but it's far more likely she was concealing drug use than her life was in danger, and she never said a word to anyone. We see this kind of behavior in inner-city youth all the time.
She said she was trying to protect me, I reminded stiffly. That's why she couldn't say anything.
Protect you from what?
I don't know. That's what we need to find out. Can't you just reopen her case and try to find out who this boyfriend was? Surely someone somewhere saw the man. In her message, it sounded like she was hiding from someone. She said he was coming. She said she didn't think he'd let her out of the country. Obviously someone was threatening her. He studied me a moment, then sighed heavily.
Miss Lane, your sister's arms had holes in them. The kind of holes that needles make.
I flew to my feet, instantly livid.
My sister's whole body had holes in it, Inspector. Not just her arms. The coroner said they looked like teeth marks.
Not of any person or animal he'd been able to identify, though.
And parts of her were just torn.
I was shaking. I hated the memory. It made me sick to my stomach. I hoped she'd been dead when it had happened. I was pretty sure she hadn't been. The sight of her had pushed Mom and Dad right over the edge. It did the same to me, but I came back from that hellish place because somebody had to.
We examined her ourselves, Miss Lane. Neither animal nor human teeth made those marks.
Needles didn't either, I said furiously.
If you'll just sit back.
Are you going to reopen a case or not? I demanded. He raised his hands, palms upturned.
Look, I can't afford to send men out on cases that have no leads when we're up to our ears and ones that do. There's been a recent spike in homicides and missing persons like we've never seen before.
He looked disgusted.
It's as if half the damn city's gone crazy. We're short-staffed as it is. I can't justify putting men on your sister's case when there's nothing to go on. I'm sorry for your loss, Miss Lane. I know what it's like to lose a loved one, but there's nothing else that I can do for you. I suggest you go home and help your family get through it.
And that concluded our interview. Feeling like a failure, needing to do something that would yield a tangible result, I trudged back to the inn and collected my trash bags, boxes, and broom, then sprang for a cab because there was no way I could carry it all to Alina's place. If I couldn't do anything else right, at least I could sweep up trash. I did every night I closed at the brickyard and was darned good at it. I cried the whole time I swept. Sorry for Alina, sorry for myself, sorry for the state of a world in which someone like my sister could be murdered so brutally. When I was done sweeping and crying, I sat cross-legged on the floor and began packing. I couldn't bring myself to discard a thing, not even what I knew should get tossed, like torn clothing and broken knick-knacks. Each item was lovingly crated away. Someday, years from now, I might pull the boxes from the attic at home in Georgia and sort through them more thoroughly. For now, out of sight was out of mind. I spent the afternoon there and made a decent dent in it. It would take a few more days to finish up, clean the place, and see if there was any damage her deposit wouldn't cover. By the time I left, it was overcast and pouring rain. There were no cabs in sight. Because I had no umbrella and was starving, I splashed through puddles and ducked into the first pub I saw. I didn't know it, but I'd just closed the book on the last normal hours of my life. He was sitting at a table about a dozen feet from my booth, opposite a petite woman in her early 30s whose drab brown hair just brushed her collar. She was a tad easier on the eye than Mousy, which was why I noticed them, because he was drop-dead gorgeous. I mean, close your eyes and wish some guy that hot would ever look at you gorgeous. Lots of times you see it the other way around, the sultry, doomy big boy Betty Boop with a Jack Nicholson, but you don't often see a Fabio with an olive oil. Tall and hunky, with a ripped, tanned body beneath his white T-shirt and faded blue jeans, he had long blonde hair that shimmered like gold. His face had that exotic model look. His eyes were sexy brown, his mouth full and sensuous. Everything about him was gorgeous. He looked elegant yet earthy, graceful yet powerful, managed even in jeans to appear rich as Croesus. I admit I was fascinated. Though the woman wore a frothy short skirt, a silk blouse, and was smartly accessorized and polished right down to her French manicured toenails, the kindest anyone would ever call her was plain, yet he seemed to positively dote on her. Couldn't stop touching her. Then one of those stupid double visions began. I had just finished my cheeseburger and was leaning back in my booth, taking my time with my fries. I adore fries, by the way, or I used to anyway. I'd heavily salt and pepper the ketchup, then slather them with it and eat them slowly, one at a time, after everything else was gone. When his gesture suddenly seemed more unctuous than charming, and his face more gaunt than sculpted. Then, abruptly, he was gone, and for a split second something else occupied his chair. It happened so fast that I had no idea what had taken his place, just that it wasn't him for a moment. I closed my eyes, rubbed them, then opened them again. The blonde sex god was back, stroking his companion's jaw with his hand, brushing his fingers to her lips. With sharp yellow talons that protruded from a hand that looked as if a thin layer of rotting gray skin had been stretched over a corpse's bones. I shook my head brusquely, covered my face with my hands, and thoroughly rubbed my eyes this time, hard enough to smudge my mascara. I had had two beers with my meal, and although I can usually handle three or four before copping a buzz, Guinness Dark is stronger than what I drink back home. When I opened my eyes, I told myself, I'm going to see what's really there, meaning a man, not a hallucination. I guess I should have specified that last part out loud, because when I opened my eyes again, I nearly screamed. The sex god was gone, and the mousy woman had her mouth turned into the palm of a monster that was straight out of a horror movie, and she was kissing it. Gaunt, emaciated to the point of death, it was tall, and I'm talking like 9 feet tall. It was gray and leprous from head to toe, covered with oozing open sores. It was sort of human. By that I mean it had the basic parts, arms, legs, head. But that was where the resemblance ended. Its face was twice as tall as a human head and squished, thin, no wider than my palm. Its eyes were black with no irises or whites. When it spoke, I could see that its mouth, which consumed the entire lower half of its hideous face, wasn't pink inside. It had a tongue and gums that were the same gray color as the rest of its rotting flesh and covered with the same wet sores. It had no lips and double rows of teeth like a shark. It was, in a word, putrid. The blonde sex god was back, and he was looking at me. Hard. He was no longer conversing with the woman, but staring straight at me. He didn't look pleased. I blinked. I don't know how I knew what I knew in that moment. It was like it was programmed into me on a cellular level somehow. My mind was split into separate camps. The first camp was insisting what I'd just seen wasn't real. The second was demanding I scramble up, grab my purse, throw money down on the table, and run out the door as fast as I could. Camps 1 and 2 sounded mildly hysterical, even to me. The third camp was calm, cool, composed, and icily insisting that I had better do whatever I had to do to convince whatever was sitting at that table, masquerading as human, that I really couldn't see what it looked like beneath its facade, or I was dead. That was the voice I obeyed without hesitation. I forced myself to smile at him, it, and duck my head as if blushingly flustered to find myself the focus of such a sex god's attention. When I looked back up, it was the gray leprous thing again. Its head was way higher than where the sex gods would have been, and it was all I could do to focus on the thing's navel. It didn't have one, which was where the sex god's head would have been if I was still seeing it. I could feel its suspicious gaze on me. I gave its navel region what I hoped was another flustered, self-effacing smile, then returned my attention to my fries. I have never eaten French fries since. I forced myself to stay there and eat the entire platter, one by one. I forced myself to pretend the rotting monster was a gorgeous man. To this day, I believe it was only because I stayed that it found my bluff convincing. I still have to swallow the urge to vomit every time I see a plate of fries. It was feeding off her each time it touched her, stealing a little more of her beauty through the open sores on its hands. As I ate my fries, I watched her hair turn duller, her complexion muddier. She grew plainer, drabber, grayer each time it touched her. I suspected she'd once been a stunningly beautiful woman. I wondered what would be left of her when it was done. I wondered if she would wake up tomorrow morning, look in the mirror, and scream. I wondered if her friends and family would recognize her, know who she'd once been. They left before I did, the short, ugly woman and the 9-foot monster. I sat for a long time after they'd gone, staring into a third beer. When at last I paid my tab and rose from the booth, I headed straight for Jericho Barrens. 8. It was only 7:30, but the relentless driving rain had ushered in the night while I'd been sitting in the pub. The streets were dark and mostly deserted, with few tourists thirsty enough to brave the downpour for a pint of stout when their hotel lounge would serve just as well. Tips in the pubs would be light for bartenders tonight. A sodden, folded newspaper clutched to my head. I sloshed through puddles. I was glad I'd changed from the pretty yellow linen suit I'd worn for my interview with the inspector into jeans, a lime-green V-neck tee, and flip-flops to clean Alina's place. However, I wished I'd had the presence of mind to grab a jacket, too. The temperature had dropped sharply with the chilly rain. July in this part of Ireland wasn't real warm to begin with, especially for a girl used to the steamy summers of southern Georgia. Dublin summer topped at highs of 67 and could sink to as low as 50. Tonight was barely that. I was relieved to find the bookstore still ablaze with light. I didn't know it yet, but I had just crossed another of those lines of demarcation in my life. I used to need my bedroom completely dark in order to sleep, with no trickles of light stealing in through the blinds, no neon blue glow cast by my stereo or laptop. I would never sleep in full dark again. Barrens wasn't there, but Fiona was. She took one look at me past the queue of customers at her counter and said brightly, "Well, hello again, dear. Just look at what the rain's done to you. Wouldn't you like to freshen up? Be back with you in a jiffy," she told her customers. Smiling fixedly, she took me by the elbow and practically dragged me to a bathroom in the back of the store. When I saw my reflection in the mirror above the sink, I understood her reaction. I would have gotten me out of there, too. I looked awful. My eyes were huge, my expression shell-shocked. My mascara and liner had pooled into dark raccoon circles around my eyes. I was white as a sheet, had chewed off all my lipstick but for a streak at each corner of my mouth, and there was a big smear of ketchup down my right cheek. I was soaking wet, and the high ponytail I clipped my hair up in this morning was listing sadly behind my left ear. I was a mess. I took my time freshening up. I stripped off my T-shirt and wrung it out in the sink, then paper towel dried my bra as best I could before putting my shirt on again. The bruises on my ribs were still dark, but much less painful. I fixed my hair, then dampened more paper towels and dabbed at my face, gently removing the smudges from the delicate skin around my eyes. I dug out my on-the-go cosmetic pack from my purse, a sewing kit-sized collection of tiny amounts of the basics no proper Southern belle should ever be without that Mom had bought for Alina and me this past Christmas. I moisturized and powdered, smoothed on a bit of blush and a touch of liner, then glossed my lips moon-silvered pink again. I opened the door, stepped out, walked right into Jericho Barron's chest, and screamed. I couldn't help it. It was the scream I'd been holding down since I'd seen the hideous thing in the pub, and it had stayed inside me as long as it could. He grabbed me by my shoulders, I think to steady me, and I punched him. I have no idea why. Maybe I was hysterical. Or maybe I was just really mad because I'd begun to understand that something was very wrong with me and I didn't want it to be. When insane things start to arrange themselves in sane patterns around you, you know you've got problems. It was his fault. He was the one who'd told me impossible things to begin with. I hammered him with my fists. He just stood and took it, his hands clamped on my shoulders, his dark eyes fixed on my face. Don't get me wrong, he didn't suffer graciously. He looked pissed off to no end. But he let me hit him, and he didn't hit me back. Which was, I suspected, a pretty major concession from Jericho Barons.
"What did you see?"
he demanded when I finally stopped. I didn't bother asking how he knew. We both knew I would have come back to him only if I needed something I couldn't get anywhere else, like the answers I'd refused the last time I was there. And that meant something had happened to change my mind. His hands were still on my shoulders. Tonight, proximity to him was different, but no less disturbing. I don't know if you've ever gotten out of your car near downed electric lines in the road during a storm, but I have. You can feel the energy sizzling and crackling in the air as the lines flop and twist on the ground, and you know you're standing next to raw power that could turn on you with killing force at any second. I shrugged in his grip. Get off me! He removed his hands.
You came to me. Remember that.
He never did let me forget it. You chose, he would remind me later. You could have gone home. I think I'm going to be sick, I said.
No, you won't. You want to be, but you won't. In time, you'll get used to the feeling.
He was right. I didn't throw up that night, but I never stopped feeling like I might hurl ketchup-soaked fries at any moment.
Come.
He led me back into the main part of the store and escorted me to the same camel-colored sofa I'd occupied a few nights ago. He spread a blanket over the leather to protect it from my wet jeans. Down south, a sofa is never more important than the person sitting on it. It's a little thing we call hospitality. It was impossible to miss how badly I was shivering, and there was the small matter of the wet T-shirt, cold nipple problem I was having. I shot him a dark look and wrapped myself up in the blanket instead. With those lightning reflexes of his, he grabbed another wool throw and managed to toss it beneath my butt before it hit the sofa. He took a chair opposite me. Fiona was gone, and the sign in the window was off. Baron's Books and Baubles was battened down for the night.
Tell me,
he said. I recounted what I had seen. As before, he asked me many questions, demanding the tiniest details. He was more pleased with my observances this time. Even I felt they were keen, but then when you see death for the first time, it makes a heck of an impression.
Not death,
he told me.
The Gray Man.
The Gray Man?
I didn't know he was here,
he murmured.
I had no idea things had gone so far.
He rubbed his jaw, looking displeased with the turn of events. I squinted. What's that on your hand, Barons? Blood? He started, glanced at me, then at his hand.
Ah, yes,
he said as if remembering.
I was out for a walk. There was a badly injured dog in the street. I returned it to its owner's shop to die.
Oh, would wonders never cease? He seemed more the type to put it out of its misery where it lay, perhaps with a sharp twist of the neck or a well-placed kick, not take into account the human factor. I would later discover that my gut instinct was right. There had been no dog that night. The blood on his hand was human. So what is this Gray Man?
What you thought it was. It selects the loveliest humans it can find and steals their beauty bit by bit until nothing is left.
Why? He shrugged.
Why not? It is an unseelie. They require neither rhyme nor reason. They are the Dark Ones. The old tales say the Gray Man is so ugly that even his own race mocks him. He steals the beauty of others out of corrosive envy and hatred. Like most of the Dark Fae, he destroys because he can.
What happens to the women when he's done with them?
I suspect most kill themselves. Beautiful women rarely possess sufficient depth of character to survive without their pretty feathers,
he said dryly.
Strip them down and they crumble.
The look he gave me was judge, jury, and executioner. I made no effort to keep the sarcasm from my voice. Flattered as I am, you count me among the beautiful people, barons. Allow me to point out that I'm still alive. I encountered the gray man, and I'm still here, just as pretty as always, dickhead. He raised a brow.
Now there's a visual for you.
I was chagrined. I never called people dickheads. Oh, well, it had been a rough day. Sorry, Mom. What's wrong with me? And that's not an invitation for you to begin tallying your many perceived flaws in my character, Barons. He smiled faintly.
I told you the other night. You are a she-seer, Miss Lane. You see the Fae. Though you are capable of seeing both light and dark, it seems thus far you've encountered only the unpleasant half of their race. Let us hope that continues, at least for a time, until I have trained you. The Seelie, or Light Fae, are as disconcertingly beautiful as their darker brethren are distressingly foul.
I shook my head. This is impossible.
You came to me, Miss Lane, because you know it's not. You can rummage about in your repertoire of pretty self-delusions, looking for a way to deny what you saw tonight, or you can look for a way to survive it. Remember what I said about walking victims? You watched one get preyed on tonight. What do you want to be, Miss Lane? Survivor or victim? Frankly, I'm not certain even I can make you into the former, given the raw material I'm forced to work with. But it appears I'm the only person willing to try.
Oh, you just suck. He shrugged.
I call it like I see it. Get used to it. Stick around long enough and you might learn to appreciate it.
He stood up and began walking toward the back of the store. Where are you going?
Bathroom. Wash my hands. Scared to be alone, Miss Lane?
No, I lied. He was gone long enough that I began peering into the corners of the room, making sure all the shadows were cast by objects and obeying known laws of physics. Okay, I said when he returned. Let's pretend I'm buying into your little story for a few minutes. Where have these monsters been all my life? Walking around all over the place and I just never noticed them before? He tossed me a wad of clothing. It hit me squarely in the chest.
Get out of those wet clothes. I'm no nursemaid. You get sick, you're on your own.
Though I was grateful for the clothing, he was in serious need of a lesson or two in manners. Your concern is touching, Barons. I practically ran to the bathroom to change. I was cold and shivering, and the thought of being sick in Dublin in my cramped room by myself, without Mom's homemade chicken noodle soup and TLC, was more than I could bear. The ivory sweater he'd given me was a blend of silk and handspun wool, and fell just past mid-thigh. I rolled up the sleeves four times. The black linen trousers were a joke. I had a 24-inch waist. His was 36, and his legs were a good 6 to 8 inches longer than mine. I rolled up the cuffs, tugged my belt from the loops of my jeans, and bunched his pants at my waist. I didn't care how I looked. I was dry and already starting to warm up. So? He'd removed the damp blanket from the sofa and sponged it dry, and I sank down cross-legged on the tufted cushions and resumed our conversation without preamble.
I told you the other night. You must have grown up in a town so small and uninteresting that it was never visited by any of the Fae. You've not traveled much, have you, Miss Lane?
I shook my head. Provincial with a capital P, that was me, just like my town.
Additionally, these monsters, as you call them, are a recent development. Previously, only the Seelie were capable of free passage among the realms. The Unseelie arrived on this planet already trapped in a prison. Those few that enjoyed brief paroles did so only at the Seelie Queen or her High Council's behest.
I had gotten stuck on a phrase. Arrived on this planet? I echoed. I thought about that for a minute. I see. So these monsters are really traveling space aliens. How silly of me not to have figured that out. Can they travel through time too, Barons?
You didn't think they were natives, did you?
He managed to sound a shade drier than I had, an accomplishment I hadn't thought possible.
As for the time-traveling aspect, Miss Lane, that would be a no, not right now. But some of the Seelie used to, those of the four royal houses. Things have happened recently, inexplicable things. No one knows for certain what is going on, nor even who holds power at the moment. But word is the Fae can no longer sift time. That for the first time in eons they are as trapped in the present as you and I.
I stared at him. It had been a joke, my time travel crack.
A snort of laughter escaped me.
Oh, my God! You're being serious, aren't you? I mean, you really believe that... He was on his feet in one fluid motion.
What did you just see in that pub, Miss Lane?
He demanded.
Have you forgotten so quickly? Or is this how fast you managed to concoct a pleasant little lie for yourself?
I rose to my feet, too, my hands at my waist, my chin high. Maybe it was a hallucination, Barons. Maybe I really did catch a cold, and I have a fever, and I'm sick in my hotel room right now, dreaming. Maybe I've gone nuts. My whole body shook from the vehemence with which I shouted the last word. He kicked the table between us aside, sending coffee table books flying, and stepped nose to nose with me.
How many of them will you need to see to believe, Miss Lane? One every day? That could be arranged. Or perhaps you need a reminder right now. Come, let me take you for a walk.
He grabbed my arm and began dragging me toward the door. I tried to dig in and hold my ground, but I'd left my flip-flops in the bathroom, and my bare feet skidded across the polished wood floors.
No, get off me! I don't want to go!
I smacked at his arm, his shoulder. I was not going back out there.
Why not? They're just shadows, Miss Lane. Remember? You told me so yourself. Shall I take you down into the abandoned neighborhood and leave you with those shadows for a time? Will you believe me then?
We were at the door. He'd begun sliding the deadbolts.
Why are you doing this to me?
I cried. His hand went still on the third bolt.
Because you have one hope of survival, Miss Lane. You must believe and you must fear, or you're wasting my time. Fuck you and your let's pretend I believe your little story. If you can't give me a tell me, teach me everything I want to live, then get the bloody hell out of here.
I felt like crying. I felt like collapsing in a puddle right there at the door and whimpering, please make it all go away. I want my sister back, and I want to go home and forget that I ever came here. I want to never have met you. I want my life back just the way it was.
Sometimes, Miss Lane, he said, one must break with one's past to embrace one's future. It is never an easy thing to do. It is one of the distinguishing characteristics between survivors and victims. Letting go of what was to survive what is.
He slid the last bolt and yanked open the door. I closed my eyes. Even though I knew I'd seen what I saw tonight, a part of me was still denying it. The mind works hard to reject that which opposes its essential convictions, and monster fairies from outer space deeply opposed mine. You grow up thinking everything makes sense. It doesn't matter that you don't understand the laws that govern the universe. You know somewhere out there some geeky scientist does, and there's a degree of comfort in that. I knew there wasn't a scientist alive that would believe my story, and there was no degree of comfort in that. Then again, I suspected there would be even less comfort in dying like Alina had. I couldn't honestly say, tell me, teach me everything, when all I really wanted to do was cover my ears and chant a childish, I can't hear you. But I could say with complete sincerity that I wanted to live. All right, Barons, I said heavily. Close the door. I'm listening. 9. Fae, a.k.a. the Tuatha De Dananna, divided into two courts, the Seelie, or Light Court, and the Unseelie, or Dark Court. Both courts have different castes of Fae, with the four royal houses occupying the highest caste of each. The Seelie Queen and her chosen consort rule the Light Court, The Unseelie King and his current concubine govern the dock. I looked at what I'd just written in my journal and shook my head. I was sitting in my 14th pub of the day, or rather early evening. I had spent the entire day pub-hopping, staring at people, trying to have another double vision. I'd not been successful, and the longer I went without having one, the more removed and implausible the events of last night seemed, as did the insanity I was penning in these pages. Shades, one of the lowest castes of Unseelie, sentient but barely. They hunger, they feed. They cannot bear direct light and hunt only at night. They steal life in the manner the gray man steals beauty, draining their victims with vampiric swiftness. Threat assessment. Kills. Jericho Barons had told me many things last night before packing me off in a cab for the Claren House. I decided to write them down, fully aware that it read like something straight out of a badly scripted late-night sci-fi horror flick. Royal Hunters, a mid-level caste of Unseelie. Militantly sentient, they resemble the classic depiction of the devil, with cloven hooves, horns, long satyr-like faces, leathery wings, fiery orange eyes, and tails. 7 to 10 feet tall, they are capable of extraordinary speed on both hoof and wing. Their primary function? She-seer exterminators. Threat assessment? Kills. Which led us to the real kicker. She-seer. A person fey magic doesn't work on. Capable of seeing past the illusions or glamour cast by the fae to the true nature that lies beneath. Some can also see taverns, hidden portals between realms. Others can sense seely and unseely objects of power. Each she-seer is different, with varying degrees of resistance to the fae. Some are limited, some are advanced with multiple special powers. I snorted. Special powers. Somebody'd been watching too much WB and it wasn't me. The kicker was, I was supposedly one of these things. According to Barons, this true vision ran in bloodlines. He believed Alina must have had it too, and that she'd been killed by one of the fae she had seen. I closed my journal. It was already 2/3 full. Soon I would need a new one. The first half contained an outpouring of grief interspersed with disjointed memories of Alina. The next 30 or so pages were crammed with lists and ideas for tracking down her murderer. And now the latest. I was filling page after page with absolute nonsense. Mom and Dad would lock me up and have me medicated if they ever got their hands on it. "We don't know what happened, Doctor," I could hear Dad say, handing over my diary. "She went to Dublin, and she just went crazy." I suddenly understood why Alina had always hidden hers. I blinked and replayed that in my mind. Alina had always hidden hers. Of course, how could I have forgotten? Alina had kept a journal all her life. Since we'd been kids, she'd never missed a day of writing in it. I used to watch her down the hall at night, before we closed our bedroom doors to sleep, sprawled on her bed, writing away. "Someday I'll let you read it, Junior," she'd tell me. She started calling me Little Mac, as opposed to Big Mac, when we were young, abbreviating it to Junior as I got older. Like when we're both in our 80s and it's too late for you to learn any bad habits from me. She'd laugh and I'd laugh too, because Alina didn't have any bad habits, and we both knew it. Her journal had been her confidant, her best friend. She had told it things she'd never told me. I knew because I'd found more than a few. As I had matured, I stopped hunting for her diaries, but she hadn't stopped hiding them. Though she'd packed the one she'd written in her younger years away in a locked trunk in the attic, she had never stopped teasing me about how I would never find her latest, greatest hiding place. "Oh, yes, I will." I vowed I'd find it even if it meant I had to dismantle her entire apartment piece by piece. I couldn't believe I hadn't thought of it before, that somewhere right here in Dublin was a record of every single thing that had happened to my sister since she'd arrived, including all there was to know about the mystery man she'd been seeing. but I'd been blinded by my focus on the garter and packing and the strange things I'd been seeing. I was struck by a sudden fear. Was that why her apartment had been ransacked? Because the man she'd been involved with had known she'd kept a journal and searched for it, too? If so, was I too late? It had taken me too long to think of it as it was. I wasn't about to waste another second. I tossed down some bills, grabbed my journal and purse, and dashed for the door. It was standing there, just standing there in the darkness. How the heck was I supposed to have known when I hurtled around the corner? I was sprinting in my haste to get to Alina's place so I could find her journal and prove to myself that it was a perfectly normal man, albeit a homicidal maniac, who had killed her, not some mythical monster. If I had rounded the corner and crashed into a person, it would have startled me. As it was, I slammed into something that made the gray man look like someone I might have considered taking to senior prom. My double vision lasted less than a heartbeat, from the instant I saw it to the moment I hit it. I tried to dodge, but didn't react fast enough. I crashed into it with my shoulder, bounced off it, and slammed into the side of a building. Dazed, I stumbled to my hands and knees on the sidewalk. I crouched there, staring up in horror. The glamour the thing cast was so faint, it required no effort on my part at all to penetrate it. I couldn't see how it would fool anyone. Like the gray man, it had most of the right parts. Unlike the gray man, it had a few extra ones, too. Parts of it were underdone, and parts of it were horrifyingly overdone. Its head was huge, hairless, and covered with dozens of eyes. It had more mouths than I could count. At least, that's what I think the wet, pink, leech-like suckers all over the misshapen head and stomach were. I could see the flash of sharp teeth as the moist puckers expanded and contracted in the gray, wrinkled flesh with what sure looked to me like hunger. Four ropey arms hung from its barrel-like body. Two puny ones drooped limply at its sides. It stood on legs like tree trunks, and its male sex organ was distended and grotesquely oversized. I mean, as big around as a baseball bat and hanging past its knees. To my dismay, I realized it was leering at me, with every one of those eyes and all of those mouths. To my horror, it reached down and began stroking itself hard. I couldn't move. It's something I'm still ashamed of. You always wonder how you'll handle a moment of crisis, if you've got what it takes to fight or if you've just been deluding yourself all along that somewhere deep inside you there's steel beneath the magnolia. Now I knew the truth. There wasn't. I was all petals and pollen, good for attracting the procreators who could ensure the survival of our species, but not a survivor myself. I was Barbie after all. I barely managed to choke out a squeak when it reached for me. 10.
This is becoming a habit, Miss Lane,
Baron said dryly, glancing briefly up from the book he was examining when I burst into the store. I slammed the door behind me and began locking it. He raised his head again at the sound of deadbolts ratcheting home and dropped the book on a table.
What's wrong?
I think I'm going to be sick. I needed to wash, with scalding water and bleach. Maybe 100 showers would be enough.
No, you won't. Concentrate. The urge will pass.
I wondered if he was really so sure about that, or if he was just trying to condition me with constant denials to keep me from puking on his precious sofa or one of his priceless rugs.
What happened? You're white as a sheet.
I glanced at Fiona behind the cashier's counter.
You may speak freely in front of her, he said.
I moved to the counter and sank back against it for support. My legs were shaking, my knees weak. I saw another one, I told him. He'd turned with me as I'd moved. Now he stopped with his back to the end of a heavy, ornate bookcase.
So? I told you would. Was it so hideous? Is that what this is about? It frightened you.
I took a deep breath, fighting tears.
It knows I saw it.
Barron's mouth fell open. He gaped at me a long moment. Then he turned and punched the end of the bookcase with such force, books went crashing to the floor, shelf after shelf. When he whirled back around, his face was drawn with fury.
Bloody hell,
he exploded.
Unfucking believable. You, Miss Lane, are a menace to others, a walking, talking catastrophe in pink.
If gazes could scorch,